The pandemic has had a dramatic, very real impact on the lives of many millions of people in the world, hundreds of millions at least. We know that an enormous number of people have died, while possibly an equal but largely uncounted number of people have suffered long-term, debilitating damage to their lungs, hearts, brains, and kidneys. Throughout the pandemic, there have been high levels of anxiety in our society. This is another casualty count, like the long-term physical ailments to which our society has paid very little attention. There has been an avalanche of alcohol and drug-related illnesses. People have plummeted into depression over lost jobs and desperation about how to feed their children. These problems are very real. One thing that no one knows for sure is how much of the ongoing violence and in-your-face anger can be attributed to anxiety caused by the virus. In truth, there's a good argument to be made that the emotional and mental impact of the pandemic is astonishingly enormous. One estimate says that the percentage of adults reporting anxiety or depression disorders jumped from 11% to 41% as a result of the pandemic. Decades from now, when scholars look back at this period of American history, two things are likely to stand out. One, in future pandemics, we need to do a much better job of managing impacts other than the ones on which our government has focused, namely deaths and ICU visits. And two, our society, that is the American society, is in big emotional and mental health trouble if a pandemic caused by a not particularly lethal virus can have such dramatic effects on society. I'd like to take a look at a very brief passage from the book of Malachi. Malachi is one of the 12 minor prophets of the Old Testament. The minor prophets were, of course, minor only because their books are short. Their actions were not in any way truly minor compared to the so-called major prophets. Remember that the prophets were intermediaries between God and humans. God spoke through them, and often through visions, the prophets conveyed God's unhappiness and at other times offered God's forgiveness. Malachi's book provides the final prophetic words in the Old Testament, as the events described in this book also take place the latest in time. The book of Malachi tells of a time when many Jews in Judea, which is more or less what we would consider to be the southern part of Israel, were disillusioned with their fate and their faith. After the second temple had been built in 515 BC, they had expected an abundant life. Remember that their focus was on God providing them with a good life on earth, not with an afterlife. Many Jews, even most priests, had turned away from their moral responsibilities. Malachi confronts people and calls on them to renew their commitment to God. The people, however, turned a deaf ear to God. There were more than just moral problems. The economy had collapsed and the people were hungry. After the exile in Babylon, farms had been abandoned and crops were poor. We don't know who Malachi was. This wasn't even a person's name. It simply means the messenger, something that could describe any prophet. The name for the book might have been taken from Malachi 3:1. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. The book of Malachi teaches the importance of living by a strong moral code and taking part in religious practices. Malachi, because he challenged the sinful people of his day, found himself at odds with his neighbors and with the leaders of the Jewish community. In chapter 3, Malachi is telling the disillusioned people of Israel that someday they will realize that they should never have turned their trust away from God. It will become clear that God has never abandoned them, that God has been with them every step of the way, and that they will be okay. Evil will be crushed, and those who have kept their hearts open to God will be just fine. Here's the quote. "For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore, you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed." By the way, the children of Jacob are the descendants of the 12 sons and one daughter of Jacob, and these are, of course, the Israelite people. Obviously, this says that God is never going to go back on God's promise to protect and care for the Israelites. Under the Mosaic covenant, God promised 1, land, 2, progeny, and 3, God's blessing to the Israelites. So they should be able to relax knowing that they're under the hand of God. But let's look at our quote in the context of the verse that comes just before it. "For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore, you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. From the days of your fathers, you have turned aside from my statutes and have not kept them." This is very powerful. It says that God will stand by God's people and God will keep the promises made to them, even though the Israelites have repeatedly broken their side of the bargain. Recently, I got a phone call from someone at a church where I had filled in for a pastor who was on vacation. This man first apologized for calling me out of the blue, then he explained how he knew me, that he had heard a sermon of mine a long time ago, and when he found himself with a problem that he didn't know how to deal with, he thought of me. He said that he was in desperate shape, that at the beginning of the pandemic, his wife lost her job. He had already lost his job almost a year before the pandemic began, and after having no luck finding a job, he and his wife decided that they could get by for a while with him staying home and taking care of the kids while she worked. But she was no longer working. I said I was sorry, that it must be extremely difficult for them to be without any income. He said, "But that's not all." His oldest kid, he said, a teenager, had become suicidal and had to be hospitalized. He said that it had to do with the boy being isolated from his school friends and having to study at home and being stuck with 2 unhappy, unemployed parents who were constantly worried about money. I said, "My God, you've got a lot on your shoulders." "I'm glad you called me," I told him. "Hey, let's call him Jim." Jim said, "But that's not all." "What else?" I asked. He said, "Do you remember my wife's name?" I said, "No, I'm sorry." He said, "That's okay. It's Nancy." "Well, Nancy just served me with divorce papers." At that point, I asked him if there was anything else. He laughed and said no, but then he started to sob. You know that, as always, I'm going to be changing the details of this story to protect Jim's privacy, and his wife's name isn't really Nancy. I asked Jim where he was, what he was doing. He said that he was just driving around in his car and that he had pulled into a parking lot to call me. He didn't have any place to go, he said, and Jim added that he was thinking of killing himself. I won't make you wait until the end to hear how this ended up. I got him to drive to the ER and I met him there. He's now getting inpatient psychiatric care. I wonder if the panic, the extraordinary explosion in anxiety among American people is related to our abandonment of faith. It is at very best politically incorrect to belong to a church, to publicly state that you're a Christian. Over the past 30 years, church membership has been dropping and the rate has been accelerating. I don't think this comes from the heart. Society has strongly urged people to leave their churches. So it's a lot like the way the children of Jacob abandoned God. It has become too inconvenient to have faith. When things are going well, when life is good, and when society discourages faith, the price is just too high for those who might otherwise want to believe in God. That's why there was this cycle of faith in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. God had to wait until things were very bad for the children of Jacob before they would return to him. I'm not sure if what we're currently experiencing in church attendance is cyclic or not. I tend to think that it is, that there will be some sort of revival. But right now, most Americans do not have anything spiritual to hold on to, and so we're not prepared for a sustained emergency. Our relationship with God does need ongoing work. It's not something you decide is important just once and then boom, magically, in the future, you will always turn to God when you're desperate. It's far too easy to fall into the trap of thinking of God last, or not thinking of God at all. That's what prayer is for. It's not to beg God for a bicycle for Christmas. It's not to tell God you're sorry you yelled at your kid. Prayer is for developing your relationship with God. If you put yourself on a disciplined program of praying, you will incrementally learn to keep God in your mind. Praying just before going to sleep is a good way to do it, and this is why people teach kids to pray at night. The last thing we do before we go to bed often sticks with us. It swirls around in our brains as we sleep. Praying seems clumsy to some of us, and it might well be something that has just never clicked with you. Try streaming a spiritual podcast or downloading a Christian book. Listen to it on your drive to work. Listen to it instead of watching yet another Law & Order rerun. This could be your form of prayer. Another idea is just to find someone with whom you can talk about God. Maybe it's another person in your congregation or a member of your family. One thing I did when our kids were little was read the Bible to them every night. The room we did this in became known as the Bible room in our family. It was good for them, and it was very good for me. It kept God in my mind. Then when the poop hits the fan, God comes into your mind, and you realize you're not alone, that you are never alone, and that you will never be alone. And very importantly, God knows that you will come and go, that you will indeed waver in your faith, that you will make mistakes, but God will absolutely never ditch you. When you turn to God, God will be there. You will know that in the end, everything works out. You will walk in the kingdom of God now and long past the end of time. I spoke with Jim just one more time after he had been treated as a patient in the hospital for about 24 hours. He was still very sad. He cried, although he tried to hide it. I asked him if his faith was helping at all. I asked him if he realized that God is going to be with him, that God will walk with him through every step of what he is going to have to go through. He nodded, then he told me that, in fact, he had talked to his son that morning. His son, you might remember, was being treated for depression himself. When he told his son that he loved him, the boy repeated back something that this man had taught his son several years before. The boy told his dad that he shouldn't worry, that both of them would be okay, that God would take care of them. It can pay off in a very selfish way to teach your kids about faith. So as terrible as this pandemic has been, we know that this wasn't the real one, that as pandemics go, this one was actually relatively mild. The disease could have been radically more deadly. We could have failed at creating a vaccine. Now, we don't need to be paranoid. that a much more dangerous pandemic could be around the corner, I'm not at all an alarmist. I think we should live at peace and enjoy. But in the future, we should simply confront whatever we must confront and try to hand our anxiety and our anger and our fear off to God. If we can do that, we'll be prepared for whatever might happen.